For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. The trap of temptation. So we've been studying through Proverbs, and we've been talking about how the book of Proverbs is centered around the theme of the skill of living a good life. That this is good, practical, fatherly advice. It's the whole adage, the whole idea of you know, dad sitting down with his kids and being like, you know, let me tell you about the way the world works, and let me tell you about how to live your life. Because I've been around for a while, and there's some things that you can learn from me. And that's really what the book of Proverbs is King Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, sharing his wisdom about how to live a good life under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit of God. And so we talked last week about how this is about understanding God's ways and seeing things for the way that they truly are. That wisdom is a skill. This word chokmah in the Hebrew is a skill. But it's also about understanding. Proverbs 1:7 talks about the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Seeing things God's way and the way that He has made the world informs us incredibly about ourselves and about the way that the world works. And understanding the way the world works is imperative to living the life that God created us to live. And so we're beginning to see an accurate picture of our own nature, that the human race is this incredibly noble, incredibly wonderful, incredibly creative, image-bearing race that God has created for this noble purpose of community and love and truth, both with God and with one another, but that we have also rebelled against God, that we've become selfish, and so that there's no limits to the good, the love, the compassion that we can live, that we're capable of, but there's no limits to the depravity that we're capable of either. That we are a conflicted people, created for a noble purpose, yet broken. And so striving and having this constant conflict within ourselves and making decisions and choices and life choices through this grid of both having some sense of understanding of what life is all about, but also having this emptiness, this thirst, this hunger for selfishness that leaves us wanting more. And so we're talking about the skill of overcoming our own evil tendencies and living God's way. So the introduction to Proverbs is really verses 1 through 7, and then we get into the meat of the section here. And we start in verse 8. It says, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching." Now, one of the reasons you don't hear a lot of teaching series, probably the main reason you don't hear a lot of teaching series on the book of Proverbs, is because the structure is so complicated. What is the narrative thought flow of the book? It just seems like there is a lot here, there's a lot of value here, but it's not broken up very easily into a coherent flow of thought. It's just pithy, short statements about a bunch of different things thrown together. But there is narrative here. There is some structure. In fact, the book itself breaks itself up into four different sections. And the first section is essentially chapters 1 through 10. And the thing that connects them all is this statement right here. "Hear, my son." It's addressed to from a father to a son. In the first 10 chapters, we see this repeatedly over and over again. Here's just a few examples. "My son, my son, my son." Proverbs 1, Proverbs 2, Proverbs 3, Proverbs 4, and so on. This section is, more so than any other, this fatherly wisdom. It's probably intended for a young audience, for a young man that's trying to make his way in the world. And this is Solomon saying, "Listen, my son, to my words." And we see this indicated throughout the first 10 chapters of the book of Proverbs. So he says, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck." That there's something that you need to learn here. There's something of great value. Something that every person needs is an understanding about the way that the world works. And you can get some of this by learning from those who have gone before you. Now, this is tough because those who have gone before us, those who have lived life longer, have had more life experiences, do have a lot to teach us. But it's tough because when you're young, you're the least receptive to input from anybody, especially older people. The problem with youth is typically we've got it all figured out. You know, when you were 18 years old, when I was 18 years old, and we were out of high school, you know, the idea in our culture is you're starting your life and you're on your own. And you've got a high school degree, right? I mean, you've got some understanding about the way that the world works. At least that's what you think. And that's why, you know, in a lot of ways, youth is wasted on the young. Because we set ourselves on a course where we are going to learn the hard facts of life through failure. And certainly that is a potent way we can learn the hard facts of life. But there's something else. There's an alternative to that that the author of Solomon wants to point out, which is that we don't have to learn through the failure of others. We don't have to be naive regarding the traps ahead. That we at a very young age can become savvy, can become wise in understanding the way that the world works, but we have to avoid being overconfident about our own limited experience. And so we have to slow down and we have to give value to the wisdom and experiences of other people. We've talked a lot over the last few weeks about how valuable wisdom is, how God values his wisdom. Wisdom can't be bought, it must be earned. And what I mean by that is you can't just go out and pay your dues and shell out some cash or go to a university and gain wisdom there. You may well be able to get wisdom there, but you won't do it by just showing up and gathering information. It's more than that. It's more complicated than that. And it doesn't have to be earned through only personal failures and personal successes. It can also be learned and earned by being teachable, by sitting at the feet of one who is wiser and slowing down and giving value to what they say. And this is really one of the most valuable commodities there is. The benefit of learning from the experience of others who have gone before you and who understand the nuances and the complexities of life a little bit better than we are. But we have to be humble and we have to realize we don't know as much as we think we know. I'm 36 years old now, and I started at 18 thinking I knew everything about the way that the world works. I'm now at a point at 36 where I can tell you that may not be true. I'm starting to maybe get a hint of the idea that I've got a lot more to learn, and I'm grateful for that. But I've got a long way to go, as do all of we. But the quicker and the more sincerely we can get to a point of having a teachable heart where we can open our ears and listen and take in the wisdom of those who have gone before us, the better off we'll be. So he says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit.' We will find all kinds of precious wealth. We will fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us and we shall have one purse." Now, as a bunch of suburban white people, well, how does this really apply? What is the enticement here? I mean, this is really a passage about gang violence, isn't it? About laying in wait and, you know, robbing and stealing and throwing in together. A life of crime, you might sit there and think, that's not really that tempting to me. But I would challenge you to slow down, to have a teachable heart, and think about what's being said here. Because these things actually do apply when we look a lot closer. Let's just slow down. Let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Okay, we would hopefully, naturally, be adverse to a statement like that. But what that is ultimately a promise of excitement. You know, you don't have to be like everybody else. There's ways of getting ahead in this world that are much easier if you're willing to break the rules. That's exciting. That's a life where your heart pounds and there's risks. And a lot of us are drawn into things like that. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol. I mean, this is sort of one of these tough guy statements, right? But Sheol is death. And he says, let us bring calamity. You know, let us show them who we are. What's more powerful than death? We will be like death. If we band together and come together, it's a promise of power. That promise will manifest itself in different ways, in different cultures, right? But ultimately what it is saying, do you want other people to respect you? Do you want other people to, when you come, they're like, that dude's serious. That is a temptation that a lot of us can relate to. We will fill our houses with spoil, of course. The promise of easy riches is universal. Nobody doesn't like that. If you go out and offer people an easier path to get wealthy, they will all take it if they believe that it is true. Because we want more. Throw your lot in with us and we shall have one purse. You know, the statement to be thick as thieves, the idea that you can come together and be a part of something bigger than yourself, that your common life of crime connects you in ways where you have to depend on one another, where you need each other. The promise of camaraderie here is also a very basic human need. So on the surface, we find something that we and our culture might not find immediately enticing, but when we boil it down to what it is, the promise of excitement, the promise of power, the promise of riches, the promise of camaraderie, we find that there is something here that is compelling to all of us because we all have the same hole in our hearts and the thirst to be a part of something more. Excitement, whether it's taking risks. You know, being bad in itself can be an enticement. We are that far gone as a race. You know, you have that thrill, that rush of endorphins when you know you're doing something bad. Maybe it's just a little bit bad. And maybe you're even hoping you get caught because that's exciting too. But there is this aspect to human nature where we crave that excitement. We crave adrenaline rush. And that often comes by doing things that we know are wrong. Maybe you're more on the rebellious side and you're that kind of person that it's just fueled and excited by doing something that normal people don't do. You want to be viewed as a maverick. You want to be viewed as an outsider. Or you want to be viewed as everyday average Joe Schmo, but you want to have a secret life where you know in your heart that you're not like everybody else. And those are things that entice us. The promise of power, being able to excel. Being able to look around you, to look around a room and judge people in your heart and know and think in your head, you know what? I'm just a little bit ahead of you. Go to a high school reunion. It'll be rampant. You know, everyone's posturing and everyone's looking around and everyone's hoping that they can portray an image to other people that says, I'm just a little bit further than you are. We want to be influential. We want to know that our words matter, that people care about what we think. We want people to listen to us. And of course, we want to have more. We want to have more choices, more security for our family, more comfort, more toys, more freedom. We want to be the masters of our own destiny. That's what's at the heart of the human rebellion, is wanting to be like God ourselves, knowing good and evil. We live under the illusion that we are in control. And as we gain more influence and more power, that illusion thickens and increases and becomes more convincing to ourselves. That we can do what we want in this world when we want it. And that is a base part of the human fallen nature, is this desire for more. The promise of camaraderie is something that, if we're honest, we all can recognize within our hearts as well. We want friends. We want to be known. We want to be connected with other people. We were created for the purpose of community. That is who we are at the heart of our being. The scriptures say it is not good for man to be alone. And when we become disconnected and disenfranchised, and we begin to feel like we don't matter in the eyes of other people, and we have no one in our life who really knows who we are, who really cares about us, and who would really miss us when we're gone, we begin to go crazy. And we break down. And so the idea of being connected, being accepted, having a place in this world, and believing that we're not alone is very enticing to us. I've got a friend here this morning, a guy who's taught here before, is a great pastor in this church, who comes from a different culture. He was raised in Chicago and was involved in the inner city gang violence of Chicago in the 1990s. I want to bring him up and have him tell us about his story. Let's hear a hand for Conrad.
Thanks for that nice introduction. I remember when I gave my testimony in the college group, Dennis introduced me as the slut and the killer. So that's very nice. Well, I guess my story begins. I grew up in Chicago in the 90s. And it was during a time when, you know, most neighborhoods in Chicago were infested with gangs. And it's funny that it's almost like a second curriculum that's taught in schools how to navigate through the streets without getting beat up by gang members. People knew somebody who was in a gang, or they were cousins with somebody that was in a gang. Sometimes they even portrayed themselves as being part of a gang in order to get some respect, even though they weren't. And in Chicago at that time, being affiliated with a gang or, you know, having friends that were in a gang was actually something that represented power and respect. And, you know, growing up, I had some behavioral problems. I had a hard time relating to people. And I'd often get into fights and different things in school. And so I had gotten expelled several different times. And each time that happened, there was a growing sense of isolation in my life where I felt like I couldn't get in there with people who are my own age. And so I ended up actually getting involved with a bunch of guys who I grew up with in my neighborhood. And they happened to be a part of a gang. They were much older than me, and they, you know, told me that I was awesome and just accepted me. And word started to spread in my school that I was affiliated with a gang, and people were afraid of me. And I saw the potential in that. I saw that people actually accepted me and were afraid of me and respected me because of this. So eventually I ended up joining the gang, and I started doing drugs and drinking and doing all these other things. But the thing that was most appealing for me, I think, was I loved the respect that I got. I loved the fact that I was in there with these guys who accepted me, and I started turning to a life of crime. I started carrying around a gun for these guys and doing different things that they wanted me to do. And part of this was that they were using me because I was 13 years old at the time, and they knew that if I got caught doing some of these things that I would do juvenile time. And, you know, I was glad to do it. They didn't force me to do anything. Part of this was I wanted to impress them. I wanted them to say, good job. Well, as my involvement started to progress, I started getting involved in these robberies where I would do armed robberies. And I robbed a number of different restaurants and different places in the north side of Chicago. And things came to kind of a culminating point in November 7th of 1994. My friend and I robbed a gas station, and we didn't know that the gas station had been robbed probably a dozen times within the last 3 years. So, you know, we robbed that place and didn't get that much money because it was a time-release vault. But as we were running out of the gas station, I heard a number of gunshots. And I looked back and I could see the silhouette of the guy who was at the register shooting at us. And apparently he had been robbed several different times that year, and so he was ready this time. And I returned fire, and the police instantly occupied a couple square mile radius of that area. And eventually my friend and I got caught. And, you know, at the time, in Chicago, there was a string of youth violence because of the gangs, and they were trying to prosecute people who were committing these violent acts and trying to send them to the adult system. And I was, they were trying to send me over to the adult, you know, to the adult system. But as it turns out, 15 years old was the cutoff age. And I was 2 weeks away from turning 15. After all it was said and done, I mean, you know, what ended up happening was my friend ended up doing 7 years, and I ended up staying in the juvenile system. And I talked to my lawyer afterwards, and he said, you know, had you been 15 years old when this happened, you would have been spending 15 years in prison. And as I was thinking about that coming over here, I realized I would have been getting out of prison last year when I turned 30. Well, what ended up happening was I ended up spending 2 more years in there, and my parents were like, let's get this, you know, let's get him out of here. Let's go somewhere where he's safe and, you know, won't be around this bad influence. And so they decided to uproot me and take me to Columbus, Ohio. And I came here with a whole bunch of problems. And I thought, you know, if I could just escape this lifestyle, then maybe everything will be fine in my life. And what I realized was that, you know, as I came here to Columbus, I couldn't run away from myself, that the problem I had was me. And eventually, I ended up getting into an altercation with these guys and shooting at them and getting locked up here again when I was 17. This time, though, I met this guy who was the chaplain at the juvenile detention center, and he started sharing Christ with me. He started talking to me about God, and, you know, at the time, I didn't believe in God, but he was persistent and was sharing the love of God with me and what God has done through Jesus Christ. And one day after reading this book, Christianity, the Faith that Makes Sense, he pulled me aside and said, hey, so do you want to pray to receive Christ? And I said, I think I want to do that. And we prayed together. And at that moment, my circumstances hadn't changed, but I felt a sense of peace that came into my life. Well, fast forwarding a year and a half later, I ended up getting out of jail. He calls me up out of the blue and says, hey, do you want to come out to this campus Bible study on 16th Avenue? And I said, well, you know, I'm on parole and I have a curfew, so I've got nothing better to do. Yeah, I'll come out. So he brings me out to this campus Bible study, and this old guy was teaching, and he was teaching the Bible in this really cool way where he was applying the Bible in a way that I felt like was speaking directly to me. There was like a PowerPoint and all this other stuff, and I just met the people there, and I just was blown away about, you know, how friendly they were, and I just kept coming ever since. As I got to know people, I eventually opened up about my story, and a number of guys that I was hanging out with, I just spilled it out and said, you know, this is where I'm coming from. And I was nervous too, because I was afraid that they were going to judge me because of my background, and they didn't. You know, if anything, they accepted me, took me in. The other thing, though, that really struck me was that as I started to walk with God, I felt this sense that my life was actually a part of something bigger than myself, that I could serve God and have meaning and purpose in my life, which was really a replacement of that sense of wanting something in my life that had meaning or that was bigger than myself. Well, anyways, I guess the story ends where after 3 or 4 months, I'd been coming out, and you know, I started rifling through some of the books that I'd collected up to that point, which was maybe about 3 that I'd ever read in my life. And I picked up the book that I had read earlier, several years earlier, and it was, you know, Christianity, the Faith That Makes Sense. And I remember looking at the cover and thinking, this is a pretty good book. And I turned the cover over, and I saw a younger picture of Dennis's face on there. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this is the guy who wrote the book that I read several years earlier. So I drove straight up to this main office here, and I practically kicked down his door. And he was startled. He looked over and he's like, what's going on? I said, man, I just want to let you know, had you not written that book, you know, I don't think I'd be alive today. And I'm sure a lot of people say that to you, but in my case, it's really true. And I said, did you ever think when you're writing this book that it would reach somebody like me in these dark circumstances? And he said, well, I wrote it for the common person just like you. And I was so blown away. And I said, man, I just want to thank you for that. And he just looked at me. He's like, cool. And ever since then, I just felt a sense that God placed me here. And, you know, if you're here today and, you know, you have doubts about that, you know, God has placed you here and he wants to provide for these thirsts that you have that maybe you're trying to replace with these other things. Thanks.
You know, as we talk about these various traps that we face, you know, we get into these situations where we're drawn in by these base human desires for power, for money, for influence, for camaraderie. And a lot of times we get stuck and we don't know how to get out. And Conrad's story is so remarkable, not only because he got out of the inner city gang violence that he was a part of his youth, but because he went on and got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and he's now a pastor in this church that is influencing hundreds upon hundreds of high school and college students, not just with his story, but with the man that God has turned him into in the subsequent years. And it's really a testimony to the power of God to know that people can change that much, that people can be that trapped in their own temptations, trapped in devices of their own making in that way, but God can spring them by coming into their lives, by laying down some truth, by forcing us to see some hard things about ourselves that we may not want to see, and then picking us up and adopting us as children and setting us on a path for a new life. And it's never too late for that to happen. The promise of excitement, the promise of power, the promise of riches and camaraderie, these temptations we all face. It's just a matter of what culture you're a part of. If you and I grew up in inner city Chicago in that same environment, these temptations would take on that form. And we would look something like this. But the other end of the extreme is exactly the same. You know, whether it's suburban, white, upper class, middle class, lower class, wherever you are, the temptations and the hole in your heart are exactly the same. Now, we're not likely to be on the extremes of an inner city gang member or an all-time famous con man, but we face the same temptations, the same enticements in our lives. And Solomon writes, "My son, do not walk in the way with these people. Keep your feet from their path." And that's interesting, because in a way that seems like worldly wisdom. It seems like, you know, don't associate with bad people. But that's not really what we learn in the Bible. That certainly wasn't Conrad's experience. He had people that were not walking that path, but they were willing to get into his life. And so the advice here is very important. And we can look to Jesus here to get some more understanding about this. Jesus hung out with the sinners. We turn to Mark 2, 16 and 17. It says, "When the scribes, the Pharisees, saw that Jesus was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, 'Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?' And hearing this, Jesus said to them, 'It's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but it's those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but the sinners.'" And so when Solomon says, keep your path from them, we have to ask the important question of what that means. It means walk a different path. It means do not set your life direction in the same direction as these violent people. These people who are a trap into themselves. It does not say reject them. It does not say kick them out of your life. It does not say, don't associate with people like this. It says, don't let your life be like their life. In fact, what we see in the Bible again and again is that people who have the love of God, who have the truth of God, who have the wisdom of God, are called into the lives of these people, but not to let them influence how we live, but so that we can influence how they live. That we can be an opportunity to spring them from the traps of their own devices, reject their life direction, but not the people who are living it. Erykah Badu, in one of her songs, has a little proverb that I love. She says, "I pick my friends like I pick my fruit." And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. As long as we understand our friends being the people who we allow to influence our choices. And we have to have a much broader collection of relationships than just the people that we allow to influence our choices. We should have key relationships in our lives of people that we trust, people that we admire, and who we allow to influence us. But we should have many other relationships of people who we love and who we lay our lives down for and who we get into the mess of their lives and we try to allow them, try to influence their lives with the truth of God that has changed our lives as well. So we don't allow people like this to influence and change the course of our life. We change theirs by the power of God and the truth of His Word. Solomon says, "For their feet run to evil, and these people, they hasten to shed blood." that we need to be aware of those whose feet are quick to run evil. Do you know people who just as soon as there's anything naughty, just as soon as there's anything bad to do, they're the first one to sign up? That person needs you. That person is setting a trap for themselves in their life, and they are going to be doomed to repeat the disastrous consequences of each and every choice they make over and over and over again until the love of God can penetrate through the darkness in their life and things can really begin to change. I got a call this week from a girl who I knew when she was 6 years old. She had a rough family situation. I was in high school. She was related to a girl I used to date. And she and her brother had a rough childhood. I got involved. I tried to help them learn how to ride bikes and do things that seemed like it was good to do with kids. And she called me this week. I hadn't talked to her in 20 years or 18 years. And she said, I got your number. I'm addicted to drugs. I've been arrested. I've spent time in jail. And I got a DUI and a public intoxication while I was in parole in the last 2 days, and I'm going to jail for the next year and a half unless something changes. And she said, I'm really thinking about killing myself because I can't do another year and a half in jail, and my life is over, and I'm not going to be able to go to college. I'm not going to be able to get a job. I'm going to have a felony on my record, and I'm ready to die. And it was just heartbreaking to think that someone at that age, at 23 years old, thought and was convinced that they'd made so many bad life choices that there was no way out of their own trap. So we talked, and you can pray for her. Hopefully she's going to her first Bible study, the one that Conrad and I used to go to down in the college group, this Monday night. But the point is sometimes we feel so trapped by our own decisions, we fail to see that the God, the all-powerful creator God of the universe, can bring change. And we can't shut these kinds of people out of our lives. He says, indeed, it is useless to spread the baited net in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessors. Now, here we have one of these things where we have to chew on this. We've got birds and nets and strange things on the scene here. But what Solomon is saying is, he's saying all temptation is a trap. All temptation is something that wants to pull you in and make you feel stuck. And then he does something interesting. He compares bird nature to human nature. He says, indeed, it is useless to spread the baited net in the sight of a bird. I didn't know this. But a bird, apparently, when it sees you setting up a net, is like, I'm not going anywhere near you or that net. Now, a bird, by bird nature, operates on the basis of instinct, not on the basis of reason. The bird doesn't know why it doesn't want to go near the net or you. It just knows lots of things like to eat birds. And you're doing something that looks suspicious, so it's going to stay away. Right? That's all the bird knows. And so birds avoid traps when they're obvious because of their instincts. Humans, on the other hand, it says, lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. Now, we're far more complex, far more informed and intelligent than birds. We operate by reason. We would be able to sit there and say, that guy over there is setting up a net, and he's looking over this way, and he's got a cheeseburger. He's going for me. I'm not going to go anywhere near him. We would be able to reason it through. The problem, though, is in addition to our reason, we have what the scripture calls a fallen nature, which means that we get enticed towards obvious traps because that cheeseburger just looks so good. I know it's a trap. But I think, in my overconfidence in myself, that I'm the kind of person that can go into that trap, get what I want, and get out unscathed. We're more foolish than birds in that way. And we're constantly thinking that we can be the exception, that we can do these things and not get caught and not face the penalties. And constantly, over and over and over in our lives, we fall into traps of our own devices because we hunger for something more. There is a hole in the middle of our hearts, in the very core of our being, and we are trying to fill it with all kinds of things. The most popular things that we try to fill it with are excitement, power, wealth, and camaraderie. We think, we know in our hearts that there is something missing from our lives, and we think, if I can go out and have an exciting life, and, you know, do things that get my blood pumping, then I'll be full. But we go out and we do it, and it only works for a short time until it doesn't seem to fill that and scratch that itch anymore. And so we go out and we seek power, or we seek wealth, or we try to find it in relationships, and we try to get significance. We try to fulfill who we are through artificial means. And the world is filled with these traps. And none of them satisfy. Our reason is overridden by our desire to feel whole, and we become foolish, dumber than birds in the life decisions that we make, trying to find a way to quench that thirst. Bernie Madoff gave an interview to New York Magazine that I found quite interesting. In June 6, 2010, the interviewer writes, "For Bernie Madoff, living in a lie had once been a full-time job, which he carried with a constant nagging anxiety. It was a nightmare for me," he told investigators, using the word over and over again as if he were the real victim. "I wish they'd caught me 6 years ago, 8 years ago," he said in a little-noticed interview with them. And so prison offered Madoff a measure of relief. Even his first stop, the hellhole of Metropolitan Correctional Center, where he was locked down 23 hours a day, was a kind of asylum. He no longer had to fear the knock at the door that would signal the jig is up, as he put it. And he no longer had to express what he didn't feel. Bernie could be himself. Pollard's former cellmate, John Bowler, recalls a conversation between Pollard and Madoff. Bernie was telling a story about an old lady. She was bugging him for her money, so he said to her, "Here's your money," and gave her a check. When she saw the amount, she says, "That's unbelievable." And she says, "Take it back," and urged her friends to invest. Pollard thought that taking advantage of old ladies was kind of messed up. "Well, that's exactly what I did," Madoff said, matter-of-factly. "You're going to pay for that with God," Pollard warned. Madoff was unmoved. He was past apologizing. In prison, he crafted his own version of events. From MCC, Madoff explained the trap he was in. "People just kept throwing more money at me," Madoff related to a prison consultant who advised him on how to endure prison life. "Some guy wanted to invest, and if I said no, the guy said, what, I'm not good enough?" He was caught in a trap of his own devices. In making a trap that trapped people in their own devices. This is the way that the world works. This is the way that these kinds of enticements work. They pull us in and they make us think that there's no way out. Proverbs is filled with wisdom on this. "Ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. A man with an evil eye hastens after wealth and does not know that want will come upon him." This wisdom is here, it's accessible for all, yet we fall into this trap again and again and again, especially in our culture, because it's so easy. And so Solomon writes, "So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessors." It leaves us feeling defeated, stuck, and like there's no way out. And it doesn't just apply to gangsters and world-famous con men. These are decisions, these are temptations that each and every one of us face every day in our lives. Our traps may look somewhat different. They're not so extreme. But we do face opportunities to take shortcuts in business dealings. Opportunities come to fudge numbers, to turn the other way. And we eventually, even Christians, develop a double life. There's the business me and there's the rest of me. And we think, well, if I'm going to make it in the business world, if I'm going to make it in this world, I have to restrict certain character qualifications. I have to turn a blind eye to certain behaviors so that I can provide for my family. And that is the beginning of the trap that will steal your joy and crush your heart and kill your spiritual effectiveness in the lives of other people. There can't be a business you and a rest of you. God cares very much for you and all that you are and all that we do, including our business practices. In the ancient world, business was basically trade. Trade was basically done by measuring goods. And the way that you cheated primarily in the ancient world was you weighted your scales so that you could get more of what you wanted and pay less for it. And Proverbs tells us a just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are His concern. God cares about our lives and He cares about our business choices. Proverbs 20:23, differing weights are an abomination to the Lord and a false scale is not good. There are traps here that are waiting for us out in the world to get us to do something dishonest. That seems like maybe it's for an overall good purpose. That seems like maybe it's what everyone else is doing and we need to do exactly the same thing. But it is a trap. Wealth obtained by fraud dwindles, but the one who gathers by labor increases it. Whatever you gain by being dishonest, whatever you gain by taking from others, ultimately is lost. And the shortcut, the short path to this kind of life will ensnare you like a bird in a net and kill your joy. Sometimes we just get tempted to turn a blind eye to the things that we see. We're not going to do anything wrong. We're just not going to do anything about the wrong that we see. I fell into this last year. You guys know I talked already about how I was spending time down at the motorcycle shop one day a week. I wasn't an employee, I was a volunteer, and I was sitting at lunch one day, the owner wasn't there. The owner was probably the closest friend that I had there. None of these guys knew anything about God. I was trying to share my faith. They knew that I was a pastor. I was quite an anomaly to them. And I was very concerned about, you know, them understanding and being able to be a good witness to them. And we're sitting at lunch, and this one guy starts talking, and he's like, yeah, this motorcycle came in yesterday, and he bought it for a very, very cheap price. And he had told the owner, my friend, that he had bought it for a different price so that he could get more money in the deal. And he justified it. He explained that the owner owed him money, and so he hadn't been paying him back, so he was just going to get back the money that the owner owed him this way. And I found myself in a potential trap. Was I going to rat out this guy that I was having lunch with to the owner and tell him, you know, that he was being defrauded by one of his employees, in which case all the other employees would certainly know it was the goody-two-shoes pastor who did it. And so I failed. I did the wrong thing. I kept my mouth shut. And I had all kinds of justifications. I'm not an employee there. I'm just an observer. You know, I had the idea that, oh, well, you know, if I do this, then I might help my witness with one person, but destroy it with four. And so I said nothing. 6 months later, I was on a Canadian fishing trip with the owner, my friend, who did not believe in God, who was quite hostile, and we had many fascinating conversations about that. But he came to me and he said, you know, there's something that's really been bothering me. There's one of my employees is stealing from me. And I said, what's going on? And he explained the situation that I already knew about. And he said, you know, it's just a drag. You know, I found out about it from this other dude, and I just wanted to get your advice because I value your opinion. What do you think I should do about it? And I was faced again with another trap. I could continue to deny and make the same mistake that I made and go one level deeper into this and lie to my friend's face about what I'd seen and what I knew about what he was talking about. Or I could tell him the truth. A man who didn't have the same understanding of forgiveness that I understood. A man who was with me in Canada at the very beginning of our trip, and I had no idea how the relationship might progress throughout the week as a result of my confessing this. The temptation to lie yet again was intense. But fortunately, my conscience couldn't bear it. I said, you know, Tom, I was there when that happened. I knew all about this, and I didn't say anything. And there's no excuse. I've wronged you here, and I need you to know that. And he was pissed, understandably so. He had no idea that I'd known anything about it. He was confiding in me as a friend whose opinion he'd come to trust. And I disappointed him. I let him down. And I think the result of it ultimately was that he forgave me and that our friendship eventually became stronger because he understood what I'm about. But I could have done a much better job. I could have been more glorifying to God.
It's something that's totally shameful, and I'm totally ashamed here to tell you this morning that I did that. And I'm telling you that story because I work at a church, and because I'm not out in the business world on a normal basis, and I know that you face decisions like that much more often than I do. But I want you to understand, as you face these decisions, as you're out in the world and you're facing these things, this proverb, this teaching matters. Because I fell into a trap that did damage to me, it did damage to my relationships, and it did damage to my witness, to my ability to show the greatness of who God is in the life of somebody who still doesn't know God. And you're in that situation every day. I know that you are, and the temptation is great to turn the other direction. But Romans 12:21 says, don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We're not just supposed to be passive towards evil that we see. We're supposed to be the difference makers. And if we don't do it, nobody else will. And that is part of the charge. That is part of the greatness. That is part of the beauty of being a child of God, as we are not supposed to just sit back and let wrongs go unchallenged. So what's the key? What's the application that we can take away from this? The key to this, he says, is, my son, do not walk in the way with him. Keep your feet from the path. The key to keep out of the trap is to avoid the trap to begin with, is to recognize the trap and recognize what's in your own heart. Recognize what it is about you, O fallen man, O fallen woman, that makes this trap desirable. And agree with God about your own weaknesses. Romans 7:18, for I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh, for the willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. I am a fallen, broken human being, and I have to have a plan on what I'm going to do when I face temptation, because I am going to be tempted in every way. And I have to be ready. I have to be better than that bird seeing the net strewn out before him. I have to know that what are my weaknesses and what is going to draw me in. And I have to be prepared with relationships, with scripture, and with prayer to keep me from falling into these traps. Not only that, but we have to let God quench that thirst for more, that hole in our hearts, that thing that makes us constantly searching, constantly seeking, the thing that gives these traps power is that sense that we have that we're not who it is that we were created to be. And God, only Jesus Christ on the cross can quench that thirst. In John 4:14, he says to the woman at the well, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst, but the water that I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life. The only way to quench that thirst, to fill that hole, is to let God put a well that perpetually exists in your heart, feeding you, quenching your thirst, and making you the person that God created you to be. He will fill the void. And he is the only thing that can. Yes, temptation will still have its draw. Yes, we will continue to fail, and we will be less than the ideal of who we want to be, but we will be in the fight to become the people that God created us to be. I realize right now some of you are in these kinds of traps. You may have made decisions long ago, or you may have made decisions recently that have limited your freedoms and kept you from being able to be real and honest. You have things going on in your life that maybe your spouse and your children and your closest friends don't even know about because you fell into a trap. The only way out is to be honest and to pay the consequences for the bad decisions that you've made in the past and move forward. David, when he was trapped in his own sin, wrote, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters, they will not reach you. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt trapped and alone and like the hand of God was squeezing your heart because of the truth of something that you had done that you were too ashamed to let people know, God wants you to have freedom from that. God doesn't want you to live a life in darkness, a life bundled up. He wants you to live a life of joy and freedom, and that means living real. And that means being honest about who you are and about the mistakes that you've made. We have to pass this wisdom onto our children as well. The whole point of this is that life has many traps. And if we can be made aware, if we can be made wise about the way that the world works and the traps that we will face as we go through life as early as possible, then we will be better equipped to avoid them. Let your wisdom to your children be a garland. Let it be a wreath around their necks. Let your children be one of the precious few that get to know and get to understand the way that this world works. And you can do that by teaching them. You can do that by studying the scriptures with them. But probably the most important way you do this is by your example, especially when you fail. You need to let your children know that you fail. It's the totally counterintuitive thing that we just, the last thing we want as fathers and mothers is to disappoint our children or to let them see our flaws. But it is the thing that we can do when we truly fail and we truly screw up and we screw up with them. We can teach them repentance by being honest with them about our own flaws and by inviting them to see us for who we really are, which is fallen, fallible children of God who are striving for a better life for ourselves and for them. And so letting them know and bringing them into the life decisions and the life choices that you make, not only those of the past, but those of the present, is the best way of teaching them how to become and teaching them how to benefit from your experiences. I'll leave you with this. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and his law he meditates day and night. Next week, we're going to be still in Proverbs chapter 1, talking about wisdom speaking, wisdom personified. It's a really cool passage where wisdom itself talks to the fools that are.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.